From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Novelist and 2022 NEA Literature Fellow Marjan Kamali is an Iranian-American writer. The daughter of a diplomat, her family moved to the United States after the Islamic Revolution and during the Iran-Iraq War. Her fiction, not surprisingly, often examines transitions, family, memory, and the tap dance around navigating complicated and often contradictory cultural identities. Her first novel, Together Tea, is a funny and compassionate mother-daughter story that underscores the juggling act that life requires for both the women who emigrated to the United States and those who stayed in Iran. Marjan's most recent book is The Stationery Shop, a book about memory, loss, love, and social upheaval. The story spans 60 years, moving between Iran and the United States, as well as shifting back and forth through time. It's a surprising and moving novel that's currently being adapted into an HBO series. As with Together Tea, The Stationery Shop is steeped in Persian culture, poetry, and food, and informed by Iranian history. The story begins with the young protagonists, Roya and Bahman, who meet in a stationery shop. I'll let Marjan Kamali tell you the rest.
This book, it's a love story. It's about two teenagers who meet when they're 17 in 1953 in Iran. They meet in a stationery shop, and they continue to have a once-a-week rendezvous in the stationery shop, and their love blossoms into this sort of whirlwind romance, and they get engaged to be married. But on the day that they're set to get their marriage certificate, the country erupts in a violent coup d'etat, and they're separated until they reunite 60 years later in the United States.
This book opens with two epigrams, and the first is by F. Scott Fitzgerald from This Side of Paradise, and the second is Harry Truman. Perhaps we can begin with the epigram from Fitzgerald.
The Fitzgerald quote was something I came across before I even started the book. They slipped briskly into an intimacy from which they never recovered. When I read that line, I knew I wanted to write a book with that theme. The Harry Truman quote, "There's nothing new in the world except the history we do not know," I feel has several layers of meaning for this story. Because while it's true that there's nothing new in the world except the history we do not know, and in this case, particularly when it comes to Iran, I also feel, aside from geopolitics, that's very true with people. When we meet someone, it's very easy to make a snap judgment about them, to come to certain conclusions. But once we know their history, we might think of them entirely differently. And that's another theme I wanted to explore with this novel.
I read, and I hope it's true, the kernel that this story grew around actually was an event that took place in an assistant care facility. Is this true?
That is true. You know, for my first book, Together Tea, I visited lots of book clubs. And at the end of one of those book club visits, one of the members came up to me and asked if I would read at the assisted living facility where she worked. And so I went down to Duxbury, Massachusetts a few weeks later, and I did a reading. And there was an elderly gentleman in a wheelchair who kept saying things. And I wasn't sure if he was heckling me or cheering me on, but he was very vocal, and then later they had organized this lovely Persian lunch, because there's a lot of food in both my books.
Oh, yes, there is.
There sure is. And they had done a fantastic job at making some of the dishes. And he wheeled himself up to me, and he kept saying things like, "I met the Prince of Spain. Did you know I traveled with Charles de Gaulle?" And he went on and on, but people were, you know, trying to have him sort of leave me alone. And quieting him down, but I did ask him his name. He had an Iranian name. And later, when I was sharing with my father how this event had gone and I mentioned this man's name, my father said, oh, that was one of our most decorated dignitaries. He met the Prince of Spain. He traveled with Charles de Gaulle. He met all these world leaders. And I realized then that I was guilty of dismissing him, not believing him. And I kept thinking, what must it be like to be in an assisted living center with this past that nobody believes, or maybe they believe it, but they don't really care. And that did become the kernel for the stationery shop.
Well, in a way, it frames the book because we know from the beginning that these two young lovers will meet again 60 years after their lives diverge. Why frame the story this way?
It was so important to me to frame it that way because while we discussed the F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, and my whole thrust with the theme of this novel was to explore lost love, not necessarily just first love. And so I frame the story so that right off the bat, from page one or two, you know that these two people did not end up together, and you know that they haven't seen one another for 60 years. I felt that by framing the story when our two lovers are 77, not 17, I give the reader the expectation that something happened to drift them apart, something pretty monumental, but clearly they haven't forgotten one another, and now they get to see each other again for the first time in 60 years. And I think if you enter the story knowing that, it just sets up an entirely different viewpoint for you, the reader, than if you start when they're 17 and they first meet in the stationery shop.
I think it gives so much more depth to their characters. I promise I'm not going to give anything away, but certainly one thing that it enabled me as a reader to see was that within 77-year-old Roya, and we mostly see the story through her eyes, there's still that 17-year-old.
Yes, absolutely.
And I love the way it collapses time because of that. Obviously, she's still 77, but she's all of those ages.
She is all of them. And aren't we all the ages we've ever been? Yeah. I just don't believe that in our experience of it, deep in our hearts, deep in our souls, time is linear. It's circular. And at any given moment, we can access all the ages we've ever been. And it's really like Russian nesting dolls, where encased within us, we carry all our past selves, and all it takes is a particular voice or a specific scent or even a piece of melody. And you're back. You're back to that younger self. And that's what happens for Roya. So when she does see him again, she may be 77, but she is also 17.
I'd like to have you describe Iran in 1953 when the book opens, because it was a country that was on the cusp of great, great change.
Great, great change. And I must say, I wasn't around in 1953, but I did a lot of research and I spoke to many people in my own family who had lived through that time in Iran. It became clear to me that it was a very different country than what we think of as Iran today. They had a democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh, of whom most people were incredibly proud. He wanted to nationalize the oil. He was very nationalistic and independent-minded and not kowtowing to foreign powers, which did create his downfall. But also the country had a sense of a blossoming in art, in culture, theater, film, even the food culture, all these Italian cafes. And I think the people who were young before August 19th happened had an incredible sense of hope, hope that their country was going to be a great big democracy.
And Roya's parents, and most particularly her father, who's just this wonderful character, he is set on making sure his daughters are educated and they are ready to take their place in this new Iran.
Yes, and you know, I do get asked about Roya's father because he is progressive. He is very enlightened and forward-thinking. And sometimes readers ask me, well, was he an anomaly? And perhaps, I mean, he did belong to a certain class in the big city, but I based him, to be truthful, on my mother's father, who very much believed that his daughters should be educated and was not at all partaking of the chauvinistic sort of old-fashioned macho view that people associate, sadly, with Iranian men. So we have to remember that that generation of young women in the 50s, they started to go abroad to study, and they were encouraged by families who wanted them to progress.
And I think the question I asked you actually could have been more precise and less about Iran in 1953, but Tehran in 1953, because I would imagine there would be very big differences between rural areas and cities, and as you mentioned, of course, class.
Very true. So most of this novel, when we are in Iran, we are in Tehran. We're not in the villages and we're not in the outskirts. And it is important to remember that back then, more than now, there was a huge difference between what was happening in the big cities and in the villages, which over the decades created resentment and then a revolution in 1979. So everything I did say about Iran in 1953 should be qualified by saying, particularly in Tehran and with the middle and the upper middle classes.
Well, you mentioned August 19th, 1953, and you certainly write about it in the book. What happened on that day?
That day is engraved in the memory of the generation of Iranians who lived through it. And as I researched this book, I learned so much more about what happened that day. It reads like a spy thriller. What happened that day basically was a mob erupted in the middle of the city and went toward the prime minister's house and literally attacked it. Such that he had to sort of climb out the window down a ladder to escape. He was overthrown. The mob succeeded. It was a coup d'etat. Now, as to what exactly happened that day, to this day, people are in disagreement. It's now finally declassified that the coup d'etat was abetted by the UK and the US, and of course, by Iranians too. So it remains a wound in the Iranian psyche, because overnight, their leader was overthrown. The Shah solidified his power as a result of that coup and became much more of a strongman than he had been before the coup, and became way more beholden to the West than he had been before the coup. So it feels like the origin of so much trauma for the generation who saw their country change overnight by the actions of a mob. They couldn't believe it had happened, but it did.
As you were writing the book and plotting and thinking about it, how did you balance the politics, which is pivotal, with the stories of Roya and Bahman, who are clearly affected by the politics, but also have their own story that really is paramount?
Yes, that's a great question. You know, I'm only interested in the politics as it relates to the novel, in how the politics affect my characters. So I'm well aware I'm not a historian, I'm not a scholar, I'm certainly not a political junkie. I want the politics to inform my story because the politics changed the trajectory of my characters' lives. And that's my interest in it. The circumstances, the geopolitical circumstances affected their ability to be married. Other things did too, no spoilers. But it's a constant balance because as a novelist, you don't want the politics to overwhelm the story. At least I don't. I don't want to be didactic. I don't want to be preaching. if people are interested in this history, I know they can follow up and, you know, research on their own later and see what they discover. So I like to think of the politics as a backdrop to the main concern of the novel, which is the characters.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think as you're writing, you're creating characters from a country that Americans still don't know that much about. And I would imagine that's something that you have to be thinking about too.
Yes. And you know what? When I was younger, I was so aware of that sometimes I felt it was an obligation of mine to explain the history or to inform my reader. But that does not do any good for the story. So I think one thing I've learned is I can tell the story and trust that even if not every reader is well-versed with the history, they will figure it out. I give enough context for them to figure it out, but I'm not going to over-explain or worry too much that they may have a gap in their knowledge of the history, because that takes you out of the dream of the story.
That's why I was curious about it, because it's such a fine line to walk.
It is a fine line, yes. Oh my goodness.
You know, so much of this book is about love in many manifestations. Not just romantic love, though certainly that. But then there's the steadfast love that Roya has with her husband, Walter. There's the family love, the love between her and her sister, the love with her parents and their daughters. So we see that. But we also see loss. The loss of, writ large, a country. The loss of first love, the loss of a child. And I think it all connects with unfinished business that we certainly all have, but that you grapple with in this book. And it's not like the book is trying to finish up all that business for Roya, but it's taking one strand of it and putting a period at the end of it.
You said it. Don't we all have unfinished business?
Oh, yes.
And I really wanted to give my character, Roya, the gift of having some closure on her unfinished business. Like you say, this one strand of it. And you're right about the very different manifestations of love. The sisterly love, romantic, parent-child, husband, fiancé, all of that. And the love of country and the loss. Roya has so much love in her life, but sometimes when you do, you set yourself up for the potential of a lot of loss as well. And in her case, tragedies do ensue. I wanted to show that at the end of the day, for this one woman, despite all that she has lost, what she's gained outweighs it. And I wanted her at the end of the book to recognize that the losses, though they shaped her and were incredibly difficult and in many instances held her back for some time. At the end of the day, what she does have, what she has gained, what she holds dear is still far more in some ways powerful and healing. And I wanted her to have that sense of healing. And it's not a big, fat kind of emotional catharsis, but it's a very quiet healing. And sometimes that quiet acceptance, I think, can be in many ways more restorative for the character and hopefully then for the reader.
It's peace.
It's peace. Exactly. That's such a good word. Yeah, it's peace.
I have to give a shout out to Walter, who is Roya's wonderful, wonderful husband, who really supports her as she makes a decision to meet this man again 60 years after she was engaged to marry him.
Yeah, we do need to give Walter credit. You know, I've been in book clubs where some people have been Team Bahman, Roya's fiancé from Iran, or Team Walter, and they really, to my shock, argue and get at each other's throats. But I don't think one outweighs the other. Walter is incredible in his own right. And in my mind, I don't see Roya's relationship with Walter as a compromise. It's just different. It's easy to idealize the teenager she never did end up with and to romanticize, you know, what he was. But she did live a life with Walter. And sometimes I'm asked why Walter is so giving in his support of Roya and literally drives her to the Duxton Senior Center so she can see again her first love from 60 years ago. You know, I think Walter may not have done that when he was 37 per se, but at 77, he and Roya have enough of a shared history, enough of a life lived together that he's secure. And maybe he would have been even when he was younger. He is Walter after all. But he loves her so much that he wants to give her this gift of healing. And that, to me, is true love.
Again, I promise I'm not going to give away any spoilers, but the book takes several twists and it takes us to unexpected places. And I'm curious how much you plotted out ahead of time.
Oh, yes. Well, the truth is the twists were super unexpected for me too in that first draft. For this book, I wasn't that much of a plotter. I sort of wrote that first draft by the seat of my pants and I discovered the story as I went along. I did know I wanted twists because I wanted to write the kind of a book where the reader will occasionally gasp and need to catch their breath. And that's a challenge I set out for myself. So then it became a huge puzzle where I had to figure out the pieces, but I figured them out as I went along. And I have a whiteboard in my home office where I would write things, and this isn't giving anything away, like, why did Bahman disappear? For the longest time, I didn't know why he disappeared, but I knew he needed to, even before their separation. He disappears for a while when they're still in Tehran. But yeah, a lot of the twists took me by surprise, and that first draft experience was incredibly emotionally intense for me as a writer. But then when I went to revise, I became almost a different person, and everything I did was deliberate and intentional, and I reordered everything so that it would create the maximum amount of suspense that I could have in a book like this and give the reader the maximum emotional impact.
Books and writing are so important in both your books, and there's a lot of poetry in these books. So what is the role of reading in your life? You had to have come from a family where literature is valued.
Yes, definitely. You know, my grandfather, he was a writer. He published several books in Iran, mostly travelogues, travel memoirs. But I grew up with poetry being part of our daily life. And this is not uncommon for a lot of Iranians, in Iran, certainly, and in the diaspora. So, you know, if I skinned my knee, if I spilled some orange juice, my dad would recite a verse from an ancient Persian poem. They were always at his fingertips, those verses. And I grew up hearing them, if not necessarily memorizing them myself. So poetry was a huge part of my life. Poets are venerated in Iran, and they're sort of the heroes of the culture. But I read a lot. It gave me the greatest pleasure. And I feel like the cake was baked back then because I read so much as a child, and it gave me not just a desire to do what those authors did, but it almost like gave me access to all these different worlds and voices that stayed with me.
Now, you lived around the world when you were growing up, didn't you?
I did, yes.
Where did you live?
Well, I was born in Turkey, but I'm Iranian. My parents are Iranian. Then I lived in Iran for a few years. Then we moved to Hamburg, Germany. I started school there. And then we went to Kenya. And then we went back to Iran and then came to the United States. And all this moving around, I do think it helped me as a writer because we always talk about the universality of the human condition and how when you write novels, that's sort of what is the common theme all across. And for me, I had firsthand experience that what happens in the playgrounds of Nairobi, Kenya is the same as what happens in the playgrounds of Tehran, Iran, and Queens, New York. the language, the customs, the politics, outfits may be different, but the people and the human connections and desires are exactly the same.
When did you come to the U.S.?
January 1982. I came to the U.S. a few months shy of my 11th birthday. We came to New York. I had the quintessential looking out the plane window, seeing all the jeweled lights, seeing the Statue of Liberty for the first time, landing in New York City, and we lived in Queens. I went to high school in Manhattan, and those lights were specifically remarkable to me because we had come from a country in the middle of a war. And
is this the Iraq War?
Yes. Yes, the Iran-Iraq War. I was there when it started, and I was there for the first year and a half of that 8-year war. And so I remember looking at the lights and thinking, oh my God, they're allowed to keep their lights on at night. Because we had not been allowed to do that.
In your first book, Together Tea, mm-hmm. you write about the main character, Mina, and I'm quoting now. She knew how to swing her legs on that hyphen that defined and denied who she was. Iranian American. Neither the first word nor the second really belonged to her. Her place was on the hyphen. Was that your experience too?
Yes, that is my experience. And I used to resent the hyphen because it felt like you didn't belong in either culture or any culture. But I've learned to see it's a privilege to be on the hyphen because it gives you a perspective you wouldn't otherwise have. And so even though I may not feel fully Iranian or I suppose fully American, I feel it's empowering to know the best and the worst of both those cultures.
Well, speaking of the best things that a culture has to offer, we have to talk about food.
Yes.
The food in both your books, it's so rich, it's so tempting.
Mm.
Was it fun to write about?
It was so much fun to write about. I think in another life, I would have been a professional chef. I do love to cook. And it grounds me. It makes me happy. I love to eat, I guess. So there's like a huge benefit to doing it. In Together Tea, when I wrote the book, after it came out, people kept saying, how come you included so much food? And I said, did I? Because I didn't do it on purpose. It just is impossible to write about these Persian parties and these family get-togethers without including a ton of food, because there is truly always a feast. Regardless of class, the feast exists for the guests. You know, people do their best to create those feasts. And then with the stationery shop, I included a lot of food, and it was way more intentional. This time, I wanted the food to sort of play a particular role, especially because when Roya comes to America, she can't even speak English, and so the food is one way she's able to communicate through the food, through the preparation of it and sharing it with somebody like a young Walter. But yeah, I love to cook and I cook a lot of Persian food.
It was divine. It was just so wonderful to read about. It's not unusual for a writer to have an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts, which you do have, but you also have an MBA, a Master of Business Administration. And I'm really curious if the MBA proved helpful at all with your writing.
I want to think it has because it would make me feel better about
having done it.
Having done it and the time and money I spent. You know what? It helped me the most with having a thick skin because I did, as you know, I have an MFA in creative writing. I did it in tandem with the MBA. Long story there, but one thing the MBA taught me, which has served me so well as a writer, is how to have a thick skin. Because the people I was with at Columbia Business School, ready to jump into finance at the turn of the century, they were not wimpy. They could take anything. They were so tough. And from them, I learned how to have a thick skin. And that has served me well as a writer who's constantly out there.
You, congratulations, have gotten a 2022 Lit Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. What do you hope it will allow you to do?
Emotionally, it allows me to finally breathe and to stop thinking I have to somehow legitimize myself or prove that I can do this. So emotionally, it's been incredibly gratifying. Talk about being at peace. But practically, it allows me to focus on my writing, to have more time to dig deep, delve into it without other pressures and worries all the time, and quite frankly, to give back. I do think that the community of the arts, people like to complain about it or, you know, think about how hard it is to be an artist, but it's a privilege and it's empowering. And I've been inspired by so many. So I hope to give back. And I feel this allows me to focus more on giving back as well.
The Stationery Shop is being adapted into an HBO series. Another big congratulations.
Thank you.
I can't imagine how exciting that must be. Are you a part of the collaboration process? How does it work?
Well, I'm officially a consulting producer, so it means that I have some say. I'm definitely not in charge, nor should I be. And I think of it as, you know, people sometimes ask, are you worried they're going to change the book? Well, they can't change the book because the book is the book. The book is the book. It's in the bookshelves. It's online. No one can change the book. But every time a reader reads this book, they have their own interpretation of it, as they should. And I feel this TV adaptation will just be one more interpretation. I'm curious to see how it all plays out. And I will do my utmost to make sure that the story is true to the culture and as much as possible to the characters. But I also know that things will change.
And Marjan, like you, I really love cooking.
Yay!
And it's something I do a lot.
Yes.
When we hang up, I am about to put some bread on to rise.
Yay!
So if I'm attempting Persian food for the first time, mm-hmm. what do you think a good dish would be to cut my teeth on?
Okay. A lot of people are enamored by the rice dishes, especially because in the Persian way of making it, we like the bottom to be very golden and crusty and crispy, the bottom of the pot part of the rice, the tadig. So you could look at that. There are all these food blogs now. You could just go look at turmeric and saffron, Persian Mama, My Persian Kitchen. But yes, that rice dish, just to get yourself into the mood, the tadig is great. Another dish I personally love that I also hope you make is fesenjoon. It's like three ingredients. It's walnuts, pomegranate molasses, and chicken. But it's fantastic. And I believe the New York Times has a very good fesenjoon recipe if you want to just Google that. But you basically grind the walnuts in a food processor. You cook them on a stovetop in a big Dutch oven, a big pot. And you eventually add the pomegranate molasses, little cinnamon, little saffron. I'm getting hungry as we chat.
I am too. I'm making notes. And then finally, tell me what you're working on now.
Yes, the third novel. It's currently called Novel 3, which is a great title. Truly, I started writing a book about four mothers in the suburbs of New England, worried about where their kids were going to go off to college. And a nice, you know, 75 pages into that manuscript, I was like, I do not care. I don't care about this. It wasn't compelling to me. So lo and behold, it's changed. And now I'm actually writing about a friendship that spans several decades back in Iran and the U.S., and I think of it as the third in my trilogy of books set in Iran and America. And we see these girls form their bond in childhood and follow them as they go through adolescence. Women's rights movement in Iran, which people don't realize is quite robust. And, well, there's betrayal and forgiveness and all that good stuff.
I love books about friendship, so I am very much looking forward to it. Thank you. Thank you for giving me your time and for writing these wonderful books and for all your tips about cooking.
Thank you so much for this interview. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
It was a real pleasure for me as well. Thank you. That was novelist and 2022 NEA Literature Fellow Marjan Kamali. We were talking about her novel, The Stationery Shop. You can keep up with her at marjankamali.com. We'll have links to the food blog she mentions in our show notes. You've been listening to Artworks. Follow Artworks on Apple Podcasts or Google Play and leave us a rating. It helps people to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe. And thanks for listening.